I do want to thank Miss Nina Palmer, a plumber, for. I'm sorry, did I get that right? Yes, over here, for really those kind words of introduction. And what I want to say briefly is that, you know, I love poetry, and I love Langston Hughes. And so let me paraphrase Langston Hughes. And he says something like, you know, first in the heart is a dream or a vision. And then the mind figures out a way to achieve that. And then the hand seeks other hands to help. So that at the end of the day, whatever vision or dream is realized, it does not belong to one person. It belongs to all the hands to help to build it. And so what you've heard about in terms of Morgan belongs to a lot of hands. And some of those hands are here today. And I'm going to ask individuals at Morgan who are part of our team to stand and be recognized. I see Dr. Willie May, who is our Vice President for Research at Morgan, recognized. We have a member of our governing board, the Board of Regents, Winston Wilkerson and his wife Gloria, as well. Andrea Hart, who is a member of our staff and works with the Board of Regents, and her husband are here. General Prather, who keeps me straight in terms of our ROTC program at Morgan and making sure we are doing everything that we need to do there. And I do understand that one of my senior students is here, Mark Anderson, who is also a senior social work major at Morgan. And so very, very pleased to have you in our company as well. I want to take this opportunity first to thank Reverend Eric King for inviting me here to be your speaker as you celebrate something that is really, really dear and close to my heart. And what I thought I would do this morning, because I was very, very moved by all the young people that I saw here in the audience, I thought I would go a little bit beyond those accomplishments that you read about and talk a little bit about the making of a university president. What really went into the making of David Wilson? And so I want to speak about the people and the places that helped to shape me while I was in elementary school, while I was in high school, and the lessons and all of the wisdom that I gained along the way. You know, it was not easy going from rural Alabama, and I do mean rural, and from the school of hard knocks to first finish college at Tuskegee, and then to stay on at Tuskegee and get another degree, and then to go on and get two more degrees from Harvard University, and then to become the first chancellor in the history of the University of Wisconsin system to lead two statewide universities at the same time, and then now to be in a place of true purpose, the presidency of Morgan State University. And so the question that I pose this morning that I will address briefly is simply this. So what did it really take to make a short, skinny, snotty-nosed, half-literate, unexposed, and somewhat shy kid named David Wilson a success? Sister Farrell, you had it right. God had a plan. He has a plan for these children, and he had a plan for me. And so now, how did that happen? Well, some of you in the audience may have heard a little bit about my personal journey. And for those of you who have, I apologize if I'm being repetitive. But for those of you who have not, I do want to take you behind the curtain and share a little bit more of that with you this morning. So where do I begin? I would like to take you back, and this is A lot of imagination here. But I want to take you back to a little place in rural Alabama. And that place was called Talbert Place. And that was really where my late father and late mother lived for a huge part of their lives. That place was owned by a wealthy white family and was little more than a plantation. We lived in one of those little shanties on that plantation with no plumbing, no electricity. It was a two-room, as they called it, shotgun house. My mom and dad had 10 children. I was the youngest. We never knew during our early years as children what it meant to own our own home or to enjoy the benefit of going to school 5 consecutive days in a week during the planting and the harvest seasons. Because we had to pick cotton and pick okra. And so the first 5 children that my parents had, my brothers, all are and were illiterate. My father, when he passed away, could not read his name if you wrote it across the sanctuary in 10-foot letters. And so he had this system in place because there was no law in Alabama that required black children to go to school. And so my father had a system in place where he would keep us out of school 3 days a week and we would go too. And then he would reverse it the following week. And Goshen, that was really the way life was for me until I was in the 7th grade. I did not go to school 5 consecutive days until I was in the 7th grade. And so one day, I was in the 6th grade, and my 6th grade teacher was the late Mrs. Luvinia Abernathy Coates. She was the sister of the late Ralph David Abernathy. And she was stern, she was caring, but she figured out that little David had something, that he had it. And I didn't know what it was. And so she asked me on one of those days that I was in school if I would stay right after school because she wanted to talk with me briefly. And here's what she said to me. She said, David, she said, you know, if your mom and dad could ever figure out a way where you could go to school 5 days a week, you just might be able to go to college. I never, ever heard the word college before. And so I raced home after school and couldn't wait to have a conversation with my daddy. And I said, Daddy, you know, Mrs. Coates said to me today that if you would send me to school 5 days a week, I could go to college. And he looked at me and he said, boy, let me tell you something. He said, college is for white people. That was what he said. And we never spoke about it again. But then in the 7th grade, I started to go to school 5 consecutive days. And I began, if you will, to experience the magic of education. It was just so transforming, if you will. It took me places that I had could never imagine. And I think my father knew that I was determined to go to college. And so 5 years passed, and I got out of bed about 4 o'clock one morning and didn't have much to take with me to college and packed a little brown paper bag and was waiting for a ride with the parents of my high school classmate who was going to the same school as I attended. We did not have a car. And I heard someone get up in the adjacent room, and it was my father. And he came into the front room, He had on these overalls. He had one strap across his shoulder that was attached, and the other one was just loose across the other shoulder. And he said to me, he said, David, he said, you know, 5 years ago, you told me you wanted to go to college. Do you recall what I said to you at that time? And I said, yes, Daddy, I do recall, because it was so hurtful. And he said, well, let me tell you what I was really thinking. He said, what I was really thinking was, how in the heck am I ever going to pay for you to go to college? But you know, son, I've been saving for this day. He said, I've been saving for the day when I would see my little David go out that front door to college. Yes, and so he reached in his overalls pocket and he pulled out something that he called a piece of money. And he said, hold out your hand. And I held out my hand and he put the piece of money in my hand. And he put it in my hand so hard, I thought it was actually going to go through my hand onto the floor. And I looked in his face, and he was crying. It was the first time I had ever, ever seen my father cry. And he said, son, this is an investment in you. This is all that I have to give you. Make good on it. And I said to him, Daddy, I will. And as I went out the front door, and the sun was coming up, and I opened my hand, there in my hand was a crisp $5 bill. That was all that my father had been able to save up to give his son to go off to college. And needless to say, I was angry. It's like $5. I mean, the cost of going to undergrad school at the time was like $3,000. $5? Well, I went all over the country, all these different places that you've heard about, and I was just racing away from all of that. And yes, all of those places that I have been, I like to say that they benefited enormously from the leadership that we offered. But I never heard my father whisper in my ear in any of those places. However, as the Board of Regents at Morgan came out to Wisconsin to say to me, we want you to consider the presidency at Morgan, I never set foot on the campus. I said to them initially, no. I was very happy in Madison, and that was really where I wanted to stay and retire. And they said, no, just fly out one weekend and walk the campus. And so I did that, and I had on jeans and a baseball hat and walked the campus, Mr. Anderson, and indiscriminately stopped students. They had no idea who I was. And I asked them questions, what do you think about the place? I was impressed. And they were too. And I went back and basically said to the board, yes, I will consider now this serious conversation with you. So when I showed up, and I started to walk the campus now as president, I heard this little voice, and it was my father's voice. And he said, now, son, this is where you're supposed to be. This is where that investment brought you. And so now it's time for you to repay me. And I'm going to repay you. This is this head conversation I'm having with him. Repay you? What do you mean? You only gave me $5. He said, you know, I gave you a life. and I gave you purpose. Yes, sir. Repay me. I could not get that little voice out of my head. And so as I was walking across campus in October of 2010 to be officially inaugurated as President Morgan, he kept saying to me, when you stand up there and you accept the presidency, you have to repay me. And so, Reverend King, I did. I stood there in the Murphy Fine Arts Center and gave Morgan a gift of $100,000. And started the $5 scholarship program at Morgan in honor of my father. Thank you. That program today has grown in value to about $1.3 million. And we use all of the proceeds to help students like the students who will be helped by the contributions that you have given today. I want to make two or three more points, and then I will close. One day I was studying at Harvard and my mind raced a little bit and I asked another question. And that question that I asked of myself was, so how did you make it from this little red dirt road that's still red and dirt today to Cambridge to be here in this environment? And so that question led me to reflect on the ingenuity of my mother. My mother had an eighth grade education, and she was brilliant. But in this little shanty, it would be so cold in the winter because all we had was one fireplace. And she had to figure out a way to keep all of us warm. And so the owners of the shanty invariably brought down to our house Look and Life magazines. They didn't bring them there for us to read, but they knew that my mom was so creative that she would figure out a way to use these to plaster the walls to keep the cold wind out of the shanty. And so as I was reflecting on, once again, how did I gain this insatiable appetite for knowledge and wisdom, that was really where that memory landed. On those days when we would come home from picking cotton, I would literally grab a kerosene lamp. Young people, that's something I know is foreign. And I would take that around the walls of this shanty, reading all of these stories in Look and Life magazines. And so that little shanty became the library that we never had. It became the classrooms on the days that we were never there. And I went all over the world without leaving the confines of that little shanty. And so that's another aspect of the Morgan State president that I simply want to convey. That was a key ingredient in the making of me. Second, I told you I was angry. And I really held on to this anger until about 28 years ago. I've had so many epiphanies to enable me to always better myself. And that's the message that I deliver to you, Goshen, this morning and to the young people. So what happened in 1990? February of 1990, of course, was the release of Mr. Mandela. And I had been selected for an international leadership program that offered me an opportunity for 3 years to travel around the world and to meet with all world leaders. So I and four other up-and-coming leaders, we sent a letter to Mr. Mandela, to Mr. Walter Sisulu, to Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, to Shaluba, to Julius Nyerere in Tanzania, and all of them said yes, that they would meet with us. And so we went down in Johannesburg to what was the African National Congress's office, the ANC office, where in that office was Mr. Mandela, Oliver Tambo, and Walter Sisulu. And so we went up to Mr. Sisulu's office and had the most amazing conversation with him. So Walter Sisulu was imprisoned with Mr. Mandela for 27 years, of which 8 of those years were in solitary confinement. And we were really interested as up-and-coming leaders as to why he did not come across to us as a bitter person. And we went back to our rooms and we debated that question all night. We said, wait, something is wrong here. Because here we are, late 20s, early 30s. If someone had plucked us from society and locked us away for 27 years and we had not committed a crime, the only crime was, I believe that apartheid is wrong, we think we would have some anger. And so we called him up the next morning and asked if he would agree to see us again, because we could not leave Johannesburg without having that question answered. And he graciously agreed. And we went back to his office. He came in, very modest, round table. And he said, I'm going to quote him now, because some of these memories are so etched in you. He said, "Good morning, comrades. My assistant told me that I sent you away yesterday thinking." He said, "Let me tell you one thing. Thinking is a very good thing. Now, what can I do for you this morning?" And so we said, "Well, Mr. Sisulu, we left yesterday thinking that you harbored no anger or bitterness toward the society that locked you away. Were we right?" And he paused for 5 minutes, and I quote him, I mean 5 seconds, I'm sorry, and I quote him again. And he said, "You are absolutely right. And let me tell you why. Because every year of those 27 years, every month and every year, every week and every month, every day and every week, every hour and every day, I harbored no anger or bitterness, because I knew then, I know now, and I will know until the day I die that what I did and what I will always do until the last breath leaves my body was and is the right thing." And so, young people, as you board that plane and go back to the United States and seek to be leaders, you have to do the right thing. And if you're doing the right thing, there's never, ever any room in your heart for anger or bitterness. And so I came back, looked in the mirror literally, and said, "Wait, yeah, I grew up in Alabama and all these things were in place to prevent me from realizing my dream. But the reality is that no one locked me away for 27 years. No one put me in a 5x5 box for 7 years. David," I told myself, "you need to get over it." And that was an epiphany, and it came at just the right time. So let me close by actually offering another brief story. I've had several epiphanies in Africa. And when my son was 12, I decided it was time for him to have his first African experience. And so I had gone on a number of quote-unquote safaris before, and I wanted him to really experience the naturalness of the continent. And so we went to Shamwari in the Eastern Cape Province, and we were getting ready to do our first ride at 4 a.m. in the morning to go out to see the Big Five. And so the ranger turned to me and he said, "Dr. Wilson, I need to have a conversation with your son. Do I have your permission to do that?" And I said, "Sure." And so he turned to my son, Nyeri. He said, "Nyeri," he said, "let me tell you something." He said, "We are about to go into the jungle. And here's what I need you to understand, what you are about to see." He said, "Every single morning out here, when the sun rises, a lion awakens. And that lion realizes that he or she must outrun the slowest wildebeest, or they are going to go hungry. And every morning out here, when the sun rises, a wildebeest awakens. And that wildebeest realizes that he or she must outrun the fastest lion, or they are going to be dinner. And so what you need to understand is that when the sun rises out here every single day, 365 days a year, everything is running. And so to young people, run every single day. Don't repeat yesterday. Let it be a continuous relay, because you don't want to go hungry for knowledge and for wisdom. And you don't want to be gobbled up because you don't have it. And so thank you very much to the family here at this incredible church. I feel so at home, and I really applaud all of the work, Reverend King, that you and the congregation are doing to celebrate educators and then to support the young people who are coming along to be our future. God bless you. God bless you.